Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast that is absolutely hosted by Dave and Andrew. Just believe your ears and not what you're seeing in front of you. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigiser. And oh, what a feeling we have for you this week.
Absolutely. While not necessarily VIPs bad, because this film's going to be, it's interesting. I will say that.
Yeah, I mean, the same way that a multi-card collision is interesting, the same way that, like, nuclear war is kind of interesting from an abstract perspective.
Yeah, so, to this episode, me and Andrew are taking a look at Flashdance, the 1983 film that was the third highest grossing film of that year.
Yeah, underline the word gross a few times, and suddenly it seems a bit more appropriate. And David, you picked Flashdance. I want to get that clear for all of our listeners. Listener, James. Yeah. How on earth did you decide to watch Flashdance this week?
Oh boy, okay. So, the production designer on this film was the same one that Invasion of the Body Snatchers 78 had.
I remember that being a very good movie.
Yes, it was. And if I remember correctly, that was Charles Rosen who did the production design on that film and led us here. And my basic thinking at the time was, well, we haven't done anything remotely close to a musical since, you know, the very first episode of the show.
That is true.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken in terms of the counting, this is episode 39. I think we were a little bit overdue. I like the 80s. I like 1983.
I mean, the 80s too. I mean, there's a lot of highlights. And actually, in the interest of fairness, it's also important to remember that just because we're doing a cinema podcast, or a film podcast, if you're feeling less hoity-toity about it, movies are a broad spectrum, and they're not always winners. But, I mean, Flashdance is one of those movies that, for good and for ill, it's a film that people remember. It is a film that is often referenced or, the subject of jokes, whether it's Groundskeeper Willie singing Maniac in a Park or, you know, the guys from Stella lampooning the climactic dance scene. It's a film that at least it's risen to a certain level of cultural awareness.
Absolutely. And having said that, why? Why has this achieved such a level of cultural, you know, relevance? What were we thinking in 1983? I was a year away from existing, people. You can't blame this stuff on me. So, I mean, I'm getting ahead of myself here. We're going to take a step back.
Deep breath.
Exactly. And we're going to lay the groundwork for this one. So, yes, this film comes out in 1983. You're probably familiar with at least the title, which, by the way, I'm still not sure what that actually is.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. I am no closer to understanding what a Flashdance is. It's clearly wasn't the influence for Flash Mobs. I think that was just coincidence, but
Yeah. It's got nothing to do with Barry Allen either.
Yeah. So, but in terms of why we might want to look at this movie, despite the fact that we have very clearly outlined why it's not necessarily a case where anybody needs to see this movie, there are a couple key points. Number one, as we've said several times now, this film comes out in 1983. This is 2 years after the start of MTV in America, and in many ways, this is the film where you can start to really see the idea of MTV being an influence on cinema really arriving on our screens.
Yes.
You can make some debates about some earlier films, but I think by this point, it's unmistakable that the film we're discussing here was pretty much MTV the movie.
Well, at this point in time as well, Adrian Lyne, the director, I believe this is the second film that he directed?
Second film. If I remember correctly, I think Foxes was the first one he did.
Okay, but he has a background working in directing television commercials and doing work with music videos as well. So he's clearly a person that understands if the intent was to make music video the film, it stands to reason why they would get somebody like Adrian Lyne to do it. I mean, since then, he's gone on to to make both lurid erotica in the form of 9.5 weeks, which again, critically reviled and did gangbusters. And he's also made some more abstract and kind of good ones, like Jacob's Ladder is a notable one, Indecent Proposal, and that really slept upon adaptation of Lolita with Jeremy Irons as well.
We may get there one of these days, but yeah, that'll be a heck of a conversation to have when we get there. So Line, I mean, this is basically the film that really put him on the map, commercially speaking, if not critically. But the thing is, there's probably two voices that are more significant to this film than even Adrian Line at the end of the day that we need to consider. Because this film isn't just, you know, Line's second film. This is also the very first film of the producing partnership of Jerry Bruckheimer and Don Simpson, the notorious duo who would pretty much come to define mainstream action cinema throughout the 1980s, with films such as Beverly Hills Cop, going on to do Top Gun, and eventually Beverly Hills Cop 2, and other films of this nature before, you know, Don Simpson eventually passed away in the mid to late 90s. And again, I think most people from our generation are familiar with their works. You know, even in the 90s, things like Crimson Tide certainly is. And Bruckheimer is still a force to be reckoned with.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, no one else can make lightning strike a tree quite like Jerry Bruckheimer. I will say, though, that it was kind of fitting, though, that right before Don Simpson passed, though, his death inspired his young protege to follow his dreams of producing high-gloss commercial schlock.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing with, you know, Bruckheimer and Simpson, is that they're not particularly critically well-known for the most part, but the kinds of films they cranked out, the super high-gloss action, you know, cinema, with, you know, with its very compelling, very commercially influenced, and I mean commercials as in television commercial influenced visuals in terms of what they're presenting. I mean, how is Top Gun nothing less but a giant ad for the Air Force?
It almost feels like precision engineered in accordance with popular tastes, and it's a style that kind of moves alongside culture, because Top Gun is a very different film from Beverly Hills Cop, which is a very different film from Flashdance. But across all of them, there is that same slickness. And, I mean, some people might call it a cynicism that goes through them. But, I mean, one thing is clear. There's a reason that we know who Jerry Bruckheimer is, and we generally don't have that same association with a lot of producers, certainly in the kind of the post-studio era. So say what you will, but these guys have a formula, and they know how to make a lot of money off that formula.
Well, this thing, they're unapologetic schlockmeisters. Like, at no point in time were they like Merchant and Ivory and chasing awards and critical acclaim. They made basically the studio version of more or less exploitation fare, but cleaned up, slicker, much more palatable, and definitely with a, you know, sort of queuing together components from all across pop culture, including music, including commercials, including the cinema itself. Like, these guys really tend to bring it together and their works. And yeah, you're right, it's cynical, but there is something honest about their cynicism in a way.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it's very easy to forget, especially to two film grads doing a podcast where we at least try to be somewhat sensible and analytic. I mean, film is a popular medium, first and foremost. You know, the fact that masterpieces can be produced is more of an accidental outcome than anything that was ever really intended. So, I mean, like, that's not necessarily to come down too hard that, oh, well, these guys aren't Merchant and Ivory, so, you know, off you go. At the end of the day, I would much rather watch Top Gun than Remains of the Day. I mean, I like Peking duck, but I'm not going to eat that every night. So, you know, I mean, this film is not necessarily disqualified off the hop just because it's not aiming for the heights that other films are.
Absolutely. And I guess before we sort of go on, we should probably outline precisely, A, what this film's, or where this film's origins lie. Because preceding all of this, we have to acknowledge the fact that this is a film with some weirdly Canadian connections in terms of its production history. Because the film really begins with somebody from Toronto, and that is Maureen Martyr, who was a welder for a construction site in the early 1980s, and also a erotic dancer at night. And she sold her life rights, I believe it was for like $2,000.
Yeah, and it ended up being subject of a lawsuit, because this film went on to gross $150 million. And I mean, I work in law, I love reading about like the legalese that goes into any kind of film production. This one ended up being the subject of a lawsuit because Martyr then alleged that the contract she signed was unfair because it basically, the one-time lump payment, and she was owed no future royalties or proceeds from the film. And it went before the courts, and they're like, well, yeah, that seems unfair, but there's nothing illegal about it, and there's nothing we can do. You signed the contract, and you weren't pressured to do it. So those of you at home, learn from Maureen Martyr's mistakes and always read the fine print.
Absolutely. And from what I can tell, her story was pretty much brought to producers by writer Thomas Headley Jr. Now, he is somebody who worked in journalism, including in Canada, at the time. And from what I understand, he wrote the original outline and storyline for this film, helped get the rights to Maureen Martyr's life sold. And then with the duo of Bruckheimer and Simpson coming together, who, from the looks of it, were overseen by other power producers, Peter Gruber and John Peters, who would go on, I think, for most people to be known as doing Batman from 1989. They ended up going about and getting this film in development. And certain directors were approached and approached at the very least. Supposedly, Brian De Palma was close to doing this film and then chose to do Scarface, the other major 1983 film.
Yeah, you bet on the wrong horse there, De Palma.
Seemingly, at least financially. But, he went off to do that one. And ostensibly, from what's been said, I guess David Cronenberg was approached, which makes zero sense to me. And I almost have to wonder whether that's apocrypha or if there was actually a version where it was like, well, he's Canadian, he'll want to do this, right?
Yeah, they probably saw Rabid and they're like, well, if we set it in Toronto, he doesn't even have to relocate.
Precisely. But yeah, from all accounts, I don't think you ever actually signed on at any point in time or was anywhere remotely close to this. However, somebody who, when Adrian Lyne was brought on board, around the same time, the script was rewritten by one Joe Esterhaus. And Andrew, would you like to fill our listeners in on who Joe Esterhaus is?
Well, I mean, certainly through the 1980s, he pretty much became synonymous with the white man in danger narrative. His credits include Basic Instinct, certainly Showgirls. Did he also write Fatal Attraction?
I don't think Fatal Attraction was his.
Probably not, because that was the most tasteful of them. Yeah, so he grew to have a bit of an outsized reputation as pretty much a less successful Robert Evans.
Well, yes and no, because the thing is, he was still is technically considered one of the highest paid screenwriters ever, because I think it was something like, there was the film Jade that William Friedkin eventually did, that, yeah, he wrote, and I think he sold that script for over $1 million. To that one, which is, boy, if you want to talk about a bomb from the mid-90s, there's one we'll get to one of these days. But yeah, Esterhaus is, yeah, notoriously known for basically writing not only schlock, but really, I think it's safe to say, misogynistic schlock, number one. And on top of that, I mean, his tastelessness knows no bounds. He's also a bit of a sort of self-publicity-seeking jerk for multiple reasons. Just take a look at his wiki page and I'm sure you'll find all sorts of delightful details.
Yeah, I mean, he writes the kind of films that if you're 14 years old and flipping through like pay cable late at night, you know, he's your man, but you're not 14 years old forever.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, when you consider all of the pieces that are brought together here, you have Adrian Lyne, you have Joe Esterhaus, you have Bruckheimer and Simpson. And altogether, these people have come together to what is ostensibly make a film targeted at women in terms of what this film is about. And Andrew, how would you like to give us the broad strokes description of the plot of this film?
Okay. Well, Flashdance is the story of Alex Flashdance, who by day she works as a welder on a construction site. By night, she dances at Mabry's, a we'll get into whatever concept restaurant slash lounge slash nightclub this place is supposed to be. But she dances on stage. But ultimately, she, you know, doesn't have a lot of family connections. She wants something more. But it's not love. She wants to dance in the ballet. And so, you know, most of the film's struggle is her trying to negotiate these spheres of her life against the pressure of getting into the academy, where she can audition and finally assume the role of a proper dancer. Along the way, she, you know, as is typical in a movie like this, she sees her friends who have their dreams crushed and fall by the wayside. And she discovers that maybe there was something else missing. And that occurs in the form of... the most problematic love interest, Nick, the owner of the construction company, played by Michael Nouri, who is at least twice her age.
Yeah.
Also, I guess there's an odd relationship she has with retired ballerina Hannah, who the connection between them is never quite clear as far as I remember. I'll freely admit I didn't watch this film as attentively as I often do. I was also sad that Nicholas Rogue died, and this was the movie you made me watch instead. So, yeah, I mean, Alex, we're told, you know, she's independent and self-made and trying to make it on her own, but she's also surrounded by people at every turn. So really, the film is, for all of its framing, the film is the story of her falling in love and learning to benefit from that love.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, we'll get into the problematic elements of this rather simple story in a few moments, because I mean certainly there are underlying sexual politics and class issues and other wonderful subtextual material we'll get into that exists in this movie.
Well, I think first off there's just the immediate weirdness of, as you said, you've got four powerful white dudes, and especially in the form of Esterhaz, it's very, very kind of creepy white dudes. They've all come together, and they basically, like, fine-tuned this movie that in the way it's marketed, in the way that it was received by audiences, like, it very much presents itself as a woman's liberation film. But I think in its telling, we get a film that... it strays very far from that mark.
Well, and this is the thing. Not only does it stray far from that mark, the thing that's really one has to wrap their minds around with this film first, before you can even get into the politics, before you can get into anything else about this movie, mm-hmm. you have to wrap your mind around the fact that I am not positive what reality that this movie is even set in. Because... yeah. Everything about this film, in terms of its setup, in terms of its logic, in terms of its correlation to what exists outside the movie theater, is bonkers.
Yeah, this is a movie that's set in Philadelphia, but it's not the real-life Philadelphia, and it's not Rocky Balboa's Philadelphia either.
It is... Oh, man. Like, okay, where do we even begin? Because, okay, let's start with Alex herself as a character, because as we've already acknowledged... she is a young woman with a dream looking to get in, you know, to this dance academy so that she can, you know, go on and become the great dancer she knows she can be, but, you know, is allowing self-doubt to get in her way. You'd think that'd be hard to screw up, right?
Yeah, that's a very familiar trope, you know, sort of the pressures of, like, the real world versus the academy. I mean, we even see that in Father Goose to a certain extent.
Precisely.
So, I mean... it's an old story, it's a familiar story, and it's a way that Hollywood can sort of repeat that lovely little myth of the self-made individual.
Yes, but of course, you know, is being, you know, a young woman coming from, you know, I guess the wrong side of the tracks, I guess as it were, and, you know...
well, if they ever get bothered to give her a backstory, we would know for sure.
Exactly. The thing about it is, you know, we're clearly indicated, there are hints towards the fact that she's impoverished, you know, that she's working, you know, in this world. But let's start adding up certain details about this, because one of the things that's made explicitly clear in this movie is that she's 18. Now, Andrew, do you know many 18-year-old welders out there in the world?
No. Which, I mean, at least we can narrow down that the site she's working on is clearly not unionized. I mean, like, it took me 10 years of post-secondary and then a college program on top of it before I got an entry-level job in an office. So, I mean, I know guys who work in trades. And let me tell you, you can't. It's not like in the old days where you could basically walk up to the foreman and say, give me a job.
Yeah. So, that's dubious question number one. So, okay, how does she already have this job? And, of course, when you consider the fact that she's 18, and then, yes, the fact that Nick, as played by Michael Nouri, is double her age at 36, you can already start to see the additional problematic factors beyond the fact that he's her employer. But we'll get there. We'll get there. So, okay, she's 18 years old. So naturally, being an 18-year-old working, you know, as a working stiff construction site worker, we'll just take that as a given at this point. You know, with no family, she must live in a terrible, run-down apartment that, you know, is a complete death trap. Right, Andrew?
It is so much nicer than mine, it's unreal.
Yeah, she lives in an abandoned warehouse, which apparently she can rent, have all this massive space, and has converted it so it's basically like a gorgeous loft.
Well, to be fair, she also works a second job, somehow being like the featured attraction at Mawbreeze.
Oh boy, yeah. So, let's get into Mawbreeze. Putting aside the fact that from the looks of this thing, she's been a dancer there for quite some time, based upon what the film actually suggests. Which, if that's the case, this place should be shut down and everybody involved with it arrested. Mm-hmm. Because if she has worked there long before she was 18, boy oh boy is that creepy. But this is the thing. Ostensibly, Mawbreeze is a strip club, I think it's supposed to be. Like the
they go to great lengths to indicate that they're not a strip club. Or if they are, they're at least the good kind. Because, you know, a film like this, you wouldn't think that there's a clear villain. But we do have one in the form of Lee Ving, he of the incredibly punchable face. And oddly enough, the singer of the sort of proto-punk band from L.A., Fear. He plays Johnny C., who's the owner of Zanzibar, which also is a strip club in Toronto. But he's basically the greaseball of the film, and he seems to spend all of his time trying to woo dancers away from Mawbreeze to dance at Zanzibar. And that is basically, like, in the context of this film, like, that's the ultimate act of betrayal of your dreams, when it's like, instead of dancing in this place, I'll take a few things off and dance in this place for dramatically more money.
Well, this is the thing. So Mawbreeze, yeah, is basically a dive bar that offers erotic dancing that isn't stripping, as we've acknowledged. It makes it very clear.
Well, it's not erotic, it's sensual.
Okay, so it's sensual dancing. Here's the thing about this. Is okay, let's just say I'm willing to go with you on this one, your movie. That's one thing. The dancers at this club, however, are apparently, I'm assuming it's either operated by people from the local fine art department at a university in which this film takes place, because they are elaborate, borderline performance art dance numbers.
Not just borderline, like, they are. It's like, yeah. Who's controlling this? Do you just say, like, was there an open mic night once, and then a bunch of people were like, hey, we put together this routine, and then the fat unnamed owner who's always just grousing around in the background was like, hey, kid, why don't you do this three times a week?
Well, this is the thing about it, because these are elaborate dance numbers with production values that I don't know who's funding this thing. Like, is there mob money running through this place? Because, I mean, that would explain where you get the production budget to build sets to put in behind your dancers, while also having strobe lighting set up throughout this thing. Again, in a what is otherwise a dive bar.
Yeah, and point. I mean, for all this this high concept performance, yeah, I mean, you still have people banging on the table and demanding sandwiches, you know? It's like nothing about this place makes any sense. Though I realize the funding issue could be explained, especially if Alex has been dancing there since she was a teenager. Jeffrey Epstein runs it.
Oh, God. Anyways, yeah. There's no recovery
so, I mean,
from
this
that,
but... it's framed as kind of like this abstract any space because, you know, one of the running plots of the film is that Richie, the cook, also has a dream of his own where he wants to be a stand-up comedian. And by stand-up comedian, it's like the kind that only exists in movies where they just, or like Live at Studio 60 reruns, where he just stands up there and like reads single joke punchline constructs off a cue card. And, you know, he's got the freedom to do this between his shifts and that. So is this place just supposed to be the generic dream factory? I don't know.
Yeah, like, it's like, honestly, this place makes no sense. Like, I don't understand who the target audience for this bar is. Because apparently it consists predominantly of the construction workers for the crew that Alex works with. Which, okay, ends up being completely creepy in a completely different way when it's basically, hi, I go up and I do sensual dancing at night. Come check me out, and then we'll hang out together at work tomorrow.
Yeah, and it leads to that really off-putting exchange early on in the film where, before we're really introduced to him, we see Nick drinking at the bar with the owner, and he's, you know, as is the custom, absolutely transfixed by Alex from frame one. He's trying to figure out more about her, and then, you know, the other guy is like, reads off a random string of numbers, and he's like, what's that, her phone number? He's like, nah, it's a social security. She works for you. And it's like, that's how the love plot of this film is introduced. But it also begs the further question of, if Mobreys gives, if it gives Alex and all the other girls, like, all this freedom, and, well, clearly if he has their social security number, he's paying them and deducting proper taxes and that, why is it so important for her to become a ballerina then?
I don't know.
She's clearly making ends meet.
Well, making more of an ends meet. Again, warehouse to live in, folks. Like, nothing about this makes sense. And the thing about it is, yeah, she's clearly making, you know, money at Mulberry. She's making money doing her welding job. But, okay, she's not satisfied with that. She wants to do dancing for the high art of it. All right, then, fine.
Yeah, but this is the same kind of narrative where it's like, it's all about, we all want something more. We all have a big dream that we need to achieve. And I think one of the critical stumbling blocks of this film is that they never actually explain why this is her passion or why this is her dream. Because otherwise, you're like, well, sounds like you got a pretty good life in the first place. And yeah, but meanwhile, you have a woman who has the world by the seat of its pants at age 18 and is still complaining, well, it's not good enough. I have to be a ballerina, even though I'm not at all trained for it, and simply the idea of having to prove myself is enough to make me run out of nervous terror.
Yeah, because one of the things that this film establishes early on is that apparently Alex has, you know, the ability to see different types of dancers and almost reflexively imitate what they do to perfection, seemingly, for, I don't know.
So she's a plagiarist.
I guess, but I mean, okay, there's a skill set there to be able to sort of, you know, it's like people who can't read sheet music, but they can write it and play. Okay, I can see, you know, that being a skill. But the thing about it is, yeah, her big turn off at this dance academy is that as she becomes very self-conscious of the fact that she does not have any formal training at this point in time, which, okay, fair enough, I guess that's the thing, but it begs the question, well, why? Because everything that's at least suggested about her abilities here suggests that she's a talented enough dancer. Somebody recognized this fact. clearly Helen, this woman, this elderly woman she's been connected to through methods we do not understand nor frankly care about, keeps telling you need to go achieve your dreams. You would assume she would be well aware of the requirements of getting into a dance studio like this, and would be telling Alex, okay, you need to go hire this person, take this kind of training. Yeah. Any sort of reasonable steps that would help Alex achieve her dream.
And it's like the brief moments in the academy, though, signal, you know, what appears to be a sort of class divide or like a class politics, where, again, it's like, you know, I can see this movie very easily being written where it ends up being more of a conflict where you have, like, say, the other ballerinas that reject Alex and look down on her because of her blue-collarness. And then at the end, she wins over everyone by being like, look, I can incorporate these different styles together and make it flow beautifully. Or something like that. Instead, it's just like, the film presents the Academy in this weirdly sterile, quasi-antagonistic sense without ever developing that. But it seems like the root of Alex's fear and concern is the fact that, oh, well, they're expecting qualifications and I don't have them. Like, if you made a movie about a guy whose great tragedy in life is that he thinks he knows a lot about forensic science, but the police academy won't let him write the detective's exam because he has zero experience, that's not classism. That's not being unfair. That's reality, okay? My life's dream might be like performing neurosurgery, but unless I have any training or experience in that field, they're probably not going to let me in. And that's just a fact of life.
Well, this is the thing. There is a narrative shape that this is similar to, which is the innately talented individual who, by sheer chance, is discovered by somebody in a field that recognizes those skills and being given an opportunity that they, as far as they're concerned, didn't know existed and may not necessarily think they want at the time. You've seen this, you know, play out in any number of instances.
Yeah, A Star Is Born, recently remade.
Precisely. So it's one of those things where, okay, if that were the type of film that this was, they were trying to make here, that'd be fine. But no, this is explicitly supposed to be something she is pursuing. And the thing is, the majority of this film is not about her pursuing it at all. Like, it's not even a case where you see frequent scenes of her practicing and, you know, dancing. You get one explicit scene of her just, like, dance training on her own. And that's early on in the movie, and it isn't apparently towards, you know, trying to apply to this academy. It's just, here is the song Maniac, and let's just see her, and I put her in scare quotes, dance.
Yeah, like, it comes off contextually like she's just dancing because that's her passion, rather than any kind of link to the idea of ballet or the more classical tradition. So instead, this film really, like, the idea of her being a ballerina is just like the bookends to this film. And then you get, yeah, that scene of her practicing solo and then occasional visits to Hannah where it's like, what was it like when people gave you flowers? Oh, they didn't give them every night.
Here's the thing. Am I alone in suspecting that maybe Hannah's just lying?
I am so glad you twigged on that because I thought that was going to be like the real crisis of this film, because Hannah, maybe it's just the fact that the actress who plays her, you know, just quirks of her, but yeah, like, she seems almost like hesitant and trepidatious the more Alex questions her about her past as a ballerina. I so thought it was going to be like, I never actually made it, I gave up my dreams, and that's why you need to follow yours.
Yeah, precisely, which would have, you know, narrative or dramatically made sense, at least, and presented things like drama and conflict into the story, but that's not the road it chooses to go, folks. Instead, we get scenes such as Alex and her friends go work out somewhere for reasons and talk
yeah,
about
a random brightly lit room. I mean, when we talk about the music video style coming through, this is probably like the initial indicator where it's absolutely clear. Because the early dance scenes, I mean, we see Alex in her apartment. We see her on stage at Mauberies. And, like, the way it's shot, the way it's presented, like, it makes sense diegetically. Whereas the moment that the girls are talking about working out and then they walk into a door and all of a sudden we get rapid close-up cuts set to Joan Jett's I Love Rock and Roll and they're all like smiling at the camera, the movie kind of broke a little bit and my brain also broke along with it.
Well, it's the thing because here's the thing, folks. The way in which we're describing the narrative of this film makes it sound far more coherent than it really is because... really, what we have is a series of dance and quote-unquote musical sequences. And not musical as in the sense of the characters break out into song and sing along with themselves. It's just, we get dance scenes set to popular tunes. That's it. And they are surrounded by stuff ostensibly that connects to it, but not really. Like, you can literally lift almost any one of these dance sequences out of the film, and it would have... negative ramifications on the plot of this thing.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you can also lift the dance scenes wholesale out of the film and play it on MTV as a music video, which is what they did, and that's part of why this film ended up doing so well in terms of audience awareness and later on home video.
Well, precisely, and the thing, I guess there's a couple points we should sort of address here, because as much as we're knocking this film, and deservedly so, for the most part, I will say this about Flashdance. This is a visually good-looking movie, you know, in terms of how Line constructs it and brings it together. Again, I like the style. I like the sort of... I mean, again, the reality of this film doesn't look like the real world. It's this hyper-slick commercial version of what impoverished existence supposedly is. And while that brings all sorts of problems with it, I'm not going to lie and say it doesn't look cool and doesn't look great on screen.
Well, yeah, the dance sequences, I mean, they're all filmed pretty well. So are the figure skating ones, which we need to get into because that's another insane aspect of this movie. But, I mean, there's definitely that slickness. I mean, they're edited well. They're put together in an interesting way. But, I mean, yeah. that kind of becomes a double-edged sword where... there are certain points where I think in order for the dance sequence to work, it presupposes that everybody is seeing it through the camera lens. Specifically, the imagination sequence, which may be the most impressive visually constructed scene in the entire movie. The yeah. problem is that it eventually assumes, like, a POV shot and, like, close-ups during this weird strobe light of Jennifer Beals wearing kabuki makeup. Yep, I mean, that's what this film consists of. But it's like those moments, like, in The Dark Knight where Batman sneaks up on the Joker and he's only able to take him by surprise because... he's emerging from out of the film frame. If you assume that it's taking place within, like, continuous 360-degree space, it doesn't make any sense. And, like, moments like that aren't always fatal. And, I mean, it's not necessarily fatal to this film. I think the bigger problem is that there's this sense of kineticism and vitality to most of the dance sequences, and that sort of is matched by the rapid editing, by the interesting cinematography. And I feel the scenes outside of that come off as very flat and just kind of indistinct as a result. Like, it's not that the other scenes of, like, them on the job site are poorly constructed. They just come off as very flat.
Well, I think there's a couple things to sort of unpack there. Because the thing about the style of this film is... you're right. One of the big things about this movie is even though it's a dance film, it's not shot and edited like most what we would consider dance movies preceding this film. You know, it's not like watching Singing in the Rain or The Sound of Music or any of the go-to musicals of the sort of classic Hollywood period where you have, you know, you take the camera back, you can move it around, you can do that, but you're always basically showing off, hey, look at the skills of this dancer and what they can do with their body.
And correspondingly, you're frequently shooting in long take as well. You're holding the camera shot because part of the pleasure for the viewer is seeing just how incredibly and how long Gene Kelly can do an incredibly complicated dance routine.
Precisely. The thing is about this film is that's not the way it's constructed. It's constructed in short shots, quick bursts, and rapid editing. And the thing about it is the reason for that style isn't simply because, hey, it's an MTV movie, we've got to edit it quickly, cut, cut, cut. It's because Jennifer Beals, the star of this film about dance, cannot dance. Literally, she almost is never on screen as the dancer performing in this film. And all the lighting techniques, all the editing techniques are designed so that basically other performers who actually can dance appear in her place. And they edit around the fact that, yeah, it's not her. These are, so you get close-ups on, you know, her legs or her body or her torso, you know, and just editing around it. So you never quite see her face clearly. For the most part, there's a big exception to that, and we'll get to that later on. But it does all this and, as part and parcel so that we have a dance movie that isn't starring a dancer. And on one hand, it visually works in this film's favor. Like, there's no question that all those sequences are memorable. But then again, it kind of defeats the point of telling the story about a dancer when we can see no demonstrable skill on the part of anybody because it's all being faked. And the film went to great lengths to hide that fact for years, we might add. Like, this is not something that they made a particular note of prior to the release of it. This all came out later.
Well, now here's the thing that baffles me, though, because, I mean, you know, as part of the show notes, you and I, we do some cursory research, and, I mean, it's always fun to hop on IMDb for the trivia, because there's always, like, weird little anecdotes, and it's interesting to know that, like, 14 of 17 people found something interesting. But according to that, it lists Jamie Lee Curtis, Bridget Fonda, Melanie Griffith, Mariel Hemingway, Helen Hunt, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Michelle Pfeiffer, among others, auditioned for the role of Alex and were turned down. So that means there's got to be something the producer saw in Jennifer Beals, who was an unknown commodity at the time, that they said no to all these other people. And I'm like, well, if it's not because she's an incredibly talented dancer, and we clearly see in hindsight that that's not a skill she had, it's like, so maybe she's an incredibly capable actress? And I don't want to be too critical of performance styles, unless it's particularly egregious, but like, and because often it's a function of the material that you're given to work with, and I don't think this is a film of much substance, but there's nothing about her performance that's terribly compelling either. So it begs the question, why cast Jennifer Beals then?
Here's the thing. I mean, there's sort of two components to this. I think the thing that Beals does have in this film is that she can be very charming at points. And when she's just allowed to sort of be natural and play off of Michael Nouri and that, she can be very, very charming. The problem is that the character they've given her, and I put character in scare quotes loosely because it really isn't, you know, I mean, there's not much there on the page for her to play. There's this weird vacillation where at points she plays the age at which the character is written, which is supposed to be an 18-year-old, which, putting aside all the other ridiculous stuff that we've already acknowledged about her existence in this film, the idea of her being impulsive or, you know, emotionally immature, and that, I buy those sequences. Yeah, she's 18. She's going to go do something like toss a, you know, a stone through a window at somebody she's angry with. You know, these are things that aren't out of the ordinary. The problem is that then Alex is given sequences where the character is written as somebody who's of equivalent age and agency as Michael Nouri.
Yeah, and wise beyond her years. You know, that's sort of the root of the attraction between the two of them. That there's a fundamental compatibility that I just, like, I once dated a woman who was like 3 years younger than me, and I found that difficult because I'm like, I don't know, I feel like we've just seen too many different movies across that 3-year gap. So the idea of somebody literally half my age and just on the cusp of legal adulthood having like this deep, deep connection on a spiritual level with somebody literally twice her age, I find that, like, even pre-2018, I find that a hard sell.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that was one of the things that critics in 83 really hammered this film down upon, and deservedly so, because there's a sequence which, again, late in the film, probably one of the worst scenes in this movie, if not the worst scene of this movie, where Nick and her go out to a high-end restaurant and eat things like, what was it, lobster, if I'm not mistaken, or crab, something like that.
Yeah, something poor people can't afford.
Precisely. They go here, and her behavior in this scene blows my mind, because for out of nowhere, she's suddenly hyper-sexually aggressive in the scene. For
yeah.
no discernible she, reason.
It's, this ain't your daddy's footsies.
Yeah, and then this leads to a sequence where, a moment where she has a tell-off with, if I remember correctly, it's supposed to be Nick's ex-wife in this film. Yeah, he was married, folks. We never even mentioned that detail. And she, all of a sudden, she removes a portion of her clothing to reveal that she's not wearing this sort of, suit like we were sort of assuming. It's like the stripper equivalent of a suit.
Yeah, but she doesn't wear it at Zanzibar, so she's not morally compromised.
Apparently so. Yeah, it's like the whole sequence makes no sense. And I do love the fact that Michael Nouri throughout this whole scene looks embarrassed and, you know, trying to decide between, is this because the character's embarrassed in the scene, or is Michael Nouri just realizing the film he's found?
Is Michael Nouri or Nick embarrassed here? It's, but I mean, like, scenes like that, I feel especially the later work that Joe Esterhaz produced, like, I picture him, like, sitting at his typewriter, lighting a cigar with a $100 bill, and being like, well, look, it's okay, because she wants to do it.
Well, like, that's it.
Yeah. Because it's so tonally out of step with most of the other courtship scenes. And, like, when you bracket off the fact that there is that gap in age and the fact that he is her employer, once you set that aside, the two of them do have maybe not necessarily a powerful chemistry, but, like, a fairly natural back and forth with each other. I mean, they seem like people who would be a reasonably happy couple together in the real world.
It's possible. And the thing is, if the film didn't hammer home on the idea that she was supposed to be 18, like, I know apparently she was 18 at the filming of the film itself, but, you know, putting that aside, I mean, if they sort of suggested that the character was, like, even 21, 22, it would still be creepy, but you could at least get the sense that, okay, she is somebody with a firmer sense of identity, necessarily. And it would actually make a bit more sense of the plot of this movie, where, yeah, by the time you're 22, if you're not sort of on a path towards achieving, you know, becoming a professional dancer necessarily, and I say this to somebody with zero experience or knowledge of professional dancing, so take this with a massive grain of salt. But I'm reasonably sure that, like, with most, you know, professions built around physicality, there is a limited, narrow window for you to get in on those careers and develop your skills and perform at a professional level. And, okay, if she were that age, suddenly, you know, the sort of pressure and concerns that she has would make so much more sense in the context of this movie. And here, they just don't at all.
Well, I think that also speaks to the problem where, by not fleshing out her character, we're left with these questions. But ultimately, like, this is a film that wants us to root for Alex to succeed. But the issue is, it's like, the stakes of her dream, the scope of her dream, are not clear. And there's never any sense of conflict. Like, in a lot of ways, I feel like in trying to make her a grounded person, the film has just attached all these different, like, storyline trinkets to her, gimmicks, really, where, you know, Alex kind of functions as her own Mary Sue, in a sense, where it's like, we never buy for a second that she's not going to succeed, because really, what the fundamental conflict of this film ends up coming down to is whether or not she's going to accept her lover's connections to get her an audition into the dance academy or not. Right? Like, everybody likes her. She always has advice. She's there for her friends. She's beautiful. Men fall in love with her on sight. She's amazingly talented. She's hardworking. She's a capable welder. It's like everything about her is a positive. And, like, there's nothing that humanizes her. So it all just feels very abstract. But when you compare this to how this film is being sold as, like, a woman trying to make it in a man's world, it's like, Well, she's not trying to make it. From the outside, she's already made it. She's just moving through a man's world. And all she's a very passive figure for most purposes in this film's narrative.
Well, the thing about this film is that really the majority of it is driven by the side characters. And the thing about it is, yeah, part of the reason Alex lacks a character as such is because basically every other character is just a mirror image in some way, shape, or form of what she is confronting. Or at least that's the ostensible version of this.
Yeah, so I think the two main characters to pull out in that regard, because thematically they're similar, because they're also following dreams. We have Richie, who, I know you have very strong opinions of. But yes, he is the cook at Maudbury's, who does a terrible 3-minute stand-up routine where half of it is not going over so well, and he redeems it by making jokes that are specific to the fact that he is a cook there, and somehow that wins over the crowd, and that's enough to convince him to go to LA and pursue his dream of being a famous comedian. And then, like, not even a dissolve, like, the next scene, he is back, and we have to infer that time passes, and he realizes, nope, I'm not going to make it, but I can accept that. And then we have Jeannie.
Yeah, okay,
Now, Jeannie doesn't want to be a dancer.
No, Jeannie's dream in this film is to become a professional, you know, skater, and here's, or at least a... competitive skater. Oh,
figure skating. I'm like, this happens midway through the movie. It's like, so you want to be a dancer? You want to be a comedian? You want to be an ice skater? It's just, what is happening, David?
Well, here's what throws me about this. Because the thing about it is that this movie should be about Jeannie. Because the thing about Jeannie is, she is somebody who gets, she has a fraction of the scenes that Alex has. And her existence is more believable, better fleshed out, and makes far more sense.
Yeah, she gets an arc.
Yeah, like, the thing about Jeannie is, she is Alex's best friend, who her dream is to become a figure skater. And as we are clearly, is clearly illustrated, she has a not exactly great home life with a father who, at the very least, seems emotionally abusive and negligent and, you know, doesn't believe that she will achieve anything. Her boyfriend is Richie. And yeah, okay, to come back to Richie for 1 second, this guy is terrible in every way, shape, or form. Because, yeah, not only does he have this absurd dream of becoming a stand-up comedian like Steve Martin or Jerry Lewis. Dude, look at the careers of Steve Martin and Jerry Lewis. They worked their worked to the bone to get where they were in their careers, okay?
Steve Martin even more so, because, I mean, learning banjo is not easy.
Precisely. I mean, not to mention, you know, they weren't relying on saying jokes about ethnic jokes, which consist of the majority of Richie's stand-up act, quote-unquote. I mean, his jokes are awful, and just offensive and appalling.
But, I mean, like, it's the same kind of, like, stock terrible, the very hacky stand-up where it's like, okay, well, you can tell the same joke about people from Poland that, you know, my grandfather repurposes to people from the Ukraine. You know, it's just like, it's placeholder humor.
Well, it is, and the thing about it is, but it's just like, they keep repeating these jokes over and over, and somehow we're supposed to expect not only find at least some degree of humor there. It's the fact that, you know, Jeannie is finding some of this stuff funny. Like, why? Why would anybody find any of this funny?
Like, as crass and dumb as it is, though, we're kind of encouraged by the film to give Richie a full, a free pass, because he has a dream and he wants to follow it.
Precisely. And if he actually, you know, did anything to achieve that dream that made sense, we might give, you know, like Jeannie does, we might give him a pass. But no, the thing about Jeannie is, you know, she at least gets into a competition. She is going to perform. She practices.
And do you remember the name of the competition? Because they showed a banner of it, and I remember cracking up, but I forgot to write it down. It's like
same here.
American Ice International or something like that.
Yeah, it's like clearly phony, but the thing is, she goes out there, and we get, A, Laura Branigan on the soundtrack singing Gloria, which...
Hell yeah.
Automatically, you know what, as bad as this movie is, you get at least something of a pass for that. But, yeah, we get to see, you know, Jeannie go out and perform, and she falls down. She gets, you know, beat up, and she loses. And the thing about it is, okay, she's human. She makes mistakes. And the next scene is basically both Alex and her generally not uncaring father, you know, trying to cheer her up. And her father, even though he is a dick throughout the entirety of the scene or of his scenes, actually does say, you know, some gentle life. So there at least is,
yeah, there's that moment of like familial reconciliation, but it also happens like 45 minutes into the movie, so you know it's not gonna last. And let's not gloss over the fact that all it took was for her father to be supportive of her was to realize that her ass looks just like her mother's when she's skating in leotards. And it's like,
once again,
that's the bar for acceptance here.
Mm. Yeah, that's also the line that clearly I believe Joe Esterhaus wrote.
Yeah, you know it when you see it. But I mean, yeah, like, there is kind of like this nice moment, and you know, that could, I think that would be a more, going back to the idea that Jeannie should be the main character, like, I think there's something to be said for a narrative that's like, okay, pursuing your dream, that's because, like, you should pursue it because it's meaningful to you, and that not because it's tied to a certain level of achievement or recognition. Like, with her, it's like, maybe I didn't do it perfectly, maybe I did fall, but that's not going to deter me from continuing to do it, and just because I didn't win, I still enjoy it. You know, she seems to have that moment of acceptance where even though I lost, my family now appreciates me. That's not where her story ends.
Nope, because instead, after Richie takes off to L.A. to make it in stand-up comedy over the course of a solid weekend, Richie, we eventually cut to Richie coming back, and oh yeah, apparently in the time he's been gone, he never called Jeannie, and somehow this was so devastating to her, even though, quite frankly, she should count her lucky stars for having to have anything else to do with Richie ever again. Instead, she's taking the opportunity to basically hook up with Johnny C, leaving himself, not only to be, I guess, you know, basically the Harley Quinn to his Joker, I guess-ish.
Yeah, like, basically he plies her with money and the sleazeball dream of making it big by dancing at Zanzibar. But, okay, here's something that I don't get. And, I mean, not just trying to find fault, but, like, this jumps out at me as something that I cannot explain. Because in that scene, it's some kind of costume party, like Halloween or something, which would signal the passing of time if it was ever clear at any point when in the calendar year this film is taking place.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so Richie comes back and he's like, so, where's Jeannie? And everybody kind of, like, looks at their shoes and shuffles off. And then he learns that she is with Johnny and now dancing at Zanzibar. But then the next scene is Alex going into Zanzibar and like being absolutely horrified by what she sees and seeing Jeannie dancing on stage and dragging her out of there and berating her for allowing herself to stoop so low. And, you know, like, reaches into her pocket, and it's like, what's all this, then? And pulls out, like, this incredibly large wad of money and throws it in the street. It's like, first off, don't throw out your friend's money. She earned that. She doesn't have a construction company owner providing for her. But the question is, it's like, but if everybody knows this, why is Alex so surprised? Like, it's not clear if Alex is responding to, like, why is she there? Why is she intervening? Is it because Richie is bad? She's like, oh, no, now I understand that what you're doing is wrong. Or is she only becoming aware of this? What's going on, David?
See, the early scene indicates that she's hooked up with Johnny C. She's still at Mulberry's, though. The point in which Alex ends up calling back after apparently missing work for multiple days after discovering that, yeah, Nick apparently managed to secure her an audition at the dance academy there. And is so despondent that she misses the calls that Helen has died, calls to come into work, and is apparently completely missed out on what's going on at Mawberry's, that when she calls in, she asks to speak to Jeannie, and that it's that point where I'm assuming the owner, who is Mawberry himself, explains that, no, she doesn't work for me anymore. Which begs... So, either Jeannie has gotten this job within, like, the last 3 days or something. And, yeah, Alex is literally interrupting her first shift there.
So then why does she have this big wad of money? And, like, why do her... Like, if her friends know that she's shacked up with Johnny C, who the film goes out of its way to portray as a creep through and through in every scene he's in, clearly they know what she's getting into already. And they just, they don't care about it until she's late for work. And then it becomes an actionable problem.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I agree with you here. It makes no sense, but this is the logic that the movie provides us with. And honestly, trying to fight that logic is like, you know, trying to swim upstream when a tidal wave is coming at you.
But, like, I mean, it's all a pretext so we can have that big moment where Alex can show just how much she cares about her friends. But, yeah. I mean, like, again, you get this nice, like, sort of cathartic moment of Jeannie realizing the error of her ways in, you know, trying to make a living in 80s Philadelphia. And, again, there's that weird moralistic tone of, like, authenticity and selling out and body shaming. But whatever, let's put that aside. As long as it leads to, you know, the happy reconciliation of Jeannie with the man she truly loves and belongs with, Richie. That's what happens, right?
Nope, they just disappear from the film, folks.
Yeah, they are never revisited again after this moment. Like, the last thing we see of Jeannie is her crying in the street in the rain after throwing all of her stripper money in the gutter. It's like, so, for Alex, her dream works out because she learns that, okay, I guess it's okay to accept the benefits of nepotism as long as I get something out of it. Jeannie learns it's okay to not be perfect at your dreams, but if somebody stops loving you and then another person loves you, you gotta be careful because they might do it for the wrong reasons and then you should feel bad about yourself. And with Richie, well, yeah, you're not gonna make it, but that's okay. But people are also going to stop loving you along the way. Like, what is this film trying to say about pursuing your dreams?
See, here's the thing about the nepotism thing. Because I think there is a more nuanced approach that this film could have tried.
Well, of course there is. It couldn't get any worse.
Well, but it's the thing. Because the thing about it is, yeah, the easy version of this would be Alex rejects the nepotism provided by Nick in getting her the position and the favors that he's called in to accomplish that, and, you know, rejecting that and demanding, no, I'm going to do this on merit and merit alone. And I think there is something to be said for a film that makes the point that, yeah, I mean, as much as we like to promote the narrative of hard work and that it's all about, you know, who's deserving in this world, honestly, is there really a field of work out there where connections and nepotism doesn't play kind of a part?
Yeah, it's what, it's who you know, not what you know. And that's just, that's social reality. You know, yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're glad-handing people or you're somehow inauthentic because you know people that can get you an entry-level position in a dance academy. You know, there's nothing that compromises your values by doing that. But the film very much frames it as if there's a problem.
Well, it frames it as a problem, but then you get the scene where Nick is basically, you know, he does get that one moment where he turns around and says, look, I haven't given you anything. It's still up to you when you get into the room to prove that you belong there. Which, okay, good on you, movie, I guess. It's just, once it's connected to all the other problematic aspects of the Nick-Alex relationship, that's when it really starts becoming increasingly creepy, because it's like, it's not nepotism in the sense that, you know, he's Alex's father, although I guess he's old enough that he could be, you know, and getting her, or trying to get her in there, you know, they are quote-unquote lovers at this point in time. And there is something kind of unseemly about that, and again, within the confines of Hollywood and the number of, you know, filmmaker relationships where their significant other becomes their muse on screen, there's some subtextual stuff there that really kind of feels unintentionally creepy about this going forward. And yeah, it's problematic, but I agree with you. The way in which the film frames the failures of others in this film in order to, you know, position Alex like, no, take the chance, take it. That feels really awkward and weird and not really well thought out.
It feels very forced, though, especially because, like, you know, Alex ends up having, like, this big dramatic reaction where when she finds out that Nick called in the favor, because being the owner of a construction company, he also is connected to, like, the Philadelphia Board of Arts Committee or something like that.
Yeah, with his ex-wife, we should note, which, you know, leads to that whole sequence of Alex freaking out because who was that blonde you were with? My yeah, ex.
Exactly. And, you know, like, he's a guy where it's like... The only construction project of his we see is this hollowed out building that all the worksite scenes take place at, but he also drives a Porsche and is a patron of the arts. But okay, whatever you say, Flashdance. But she finds out that he basically called in the favor, and she immediately starts screaming and, like, tries to jump out of a moving car in the middle of the, you know, traffic tunnel, and it's like, it's a strong reaction. It leads to the big dramatic moment. But when you step back and be like, this is your response to somebody trying to do you a favor, so you wouldn't have to write down on your application that you have zero qualifications. You know, it's like, you want to succeed on your own merit? Well, you wouldn't have done it because you don't have any merits as far as the Academy is concerned. It feels like they came up with whatever pretext possible to shoehorn a big moment into the film.
Oh, and you're right.
It's resolved even more patly because it's just an offhand conversation where someone reminds Alex that, well, don't give up on your dreams, because if you give up on your dreams, you die. And then that's all it takes for her to be like, well, I guess I better just accept everything that 5 minutes ago I thought was sacrificing my principles as a human being. And then we get the audition.
Oh, man. Okay. And here's the point where, okay, how do you want to frame this? Because part of me wants to say that they came to filming the scene, and this is the point where Adrian Lyne said, you know what? This movie is broken and foolish and silly and dumb. And you know what? I'm going to make a scene that's for the people in the audience who are thinking exactly like me at this point. And we're just going to sit there and see, I mean, because the whole... Okay, let's start with the way in which the Dance Academy is portrayed. Because what we haven't acknowledged is that it is an environment populated by cartoons.
Yep. Cartoons because... in tweed suits with very yeah. large cigars. And everybody is wearing the largest glasses you could possibly find.
Even before we get to that scene, the secretary who runs the application center that Alex applies at, like, there is one admittedly funny bit of physical comedy with her when Nick comes in and asks about that girl who was just in here a moment ago, and she's, like, trying to choke down what she was just eating and not quite succeeding. That's legitimately funny. But again, it's part and parcel of the fact that it's like, oh, this is the upper class, you know, mockery that we're seeing here. How dare this plebeian come into our midst? I mean, that's the level at which this is played. So, yeah. Okay.
And so, so we get the scene, and we get, you know, all these shots of the stern, quizzical faces of the panel. And then we get the big scene.
Okay.
She puts on the record, and then we play the song, What a Feeling. And, all right, we'll talk about this movie soundtrack after. But the sequence itself, she begins, and then she pauses and says, let me start again. And weirdly enough, that is the last line spoken in the film, because what follows is her doing the dance scene. And am I wrong, David, but like the first, up until the drums on the song kick in, there is absolutely no form, rhythm, or structure to the dance that she's doing?
There isn't. Which, okay, that's...
She's just kind of, like, rowing around in an invisible boat on the floor. I mean, yeah. It gets better, but, like, that first bit, you know, that was when I kind of started believing you, where it's like, this is a post-ironic film before post-irony was a thing, because it doesn't seem all that impressive.
Like, no, it doesn't seem all that impressive, but it quickly picks up, and yeah, you will see some actually pretty talented dancing on this at this point. There's just one tiny little problem with that.
What's that problem, Dave?
You remember how I said the film edited around in most of the sequences Jennifer Beal, the fact that Jennifer Beal wasn't doing any of the dancing because she can't dance?
Yes.
Apparently Adrian Lyne just threw that idea completely out the window when he shot the sequence, because it is brightly lit. There are full, you know, pan or shots from the back where you can see the full on that this is not Jennifer Beals at all. There is no effort made to match skin tone, to match body type, to match facial expression, like nothing.
Well, the best part is near the end when she does the breakdancing bit. That was actually Crazy Legs, who is somewhat notable as a breakdancer and a street dancer, who also happens to be male, happens to have a mustache. And if you actually look closely, you can definitely see, oh, wow, Alex grew a mustache for 5 seconds.
It is. And the thing is, there's so much just sort of, I'm just letting it hang all out there at this point.
Yeah, you know, and especially with the judges' reactions, you know, they do the, it keeps cutting back to them, and they're getting more into it, and you see their pointy shoes, like, tapping along with the beat, and they're all like, the one guy's blowing his nose rhythmically, what the hell is going on?
I love the one judge, when you cut to her face, it's like, oh, what is this? It's breakdancing! This is unbelievable! You know, this will shake up the studio for certain! I mean, oh my god!
But
it
I
is
mean,
so
that,
over the top!
That could work if the film made more of an attempt to, like, to establish, like, some kind of barrier or conflict between Alex and the Academy. And this is the moment of being like, well, no, if you look at the world around you, you know, with the way that people dance in everyday life, the way that street performers dance, like, different styles, all of this is part of the same organic whole. And what I'm doing is I'm fusing it all together. Like, that would be a rewarding moment, because that would be a victory for inclusivity. Instead, it's like, well, we like you because you were really good at picking and choosing other stuff you saw in the last 90 minutes.
Well, there's that. But, I mean, even if you had that, the point of the matter is, once you've made it explicitly clear that your lead actor cannot dance, and this is the big dramatic crux of the film, where the character is supposed to prove they can dance, your film is fundamentally broken at this point. And this is the kind of thing where, again, this is the climax of the movie. Like, you can get everything, I mean, for all the other faults of this film, for everything else that it gets wrong, and as we've already acknowledged, it gets plenty wrong. This is the one thing that if your people were going to leave the theater and be like, yeah, that was pretty decent, you cannot screw up. And they didn't just screw it up. They did it with gusto.
It's like you have to actually make a concentrated effort to get that many things wrong in one fell swoop. But yeah. I don't see what Adrian Lyne would stand to gain from basically sandbagging the climax of the film deliberately. And not even the climax, like, this is the end of the film. Because the dance sequence ends, and without any dialogue, she then runs outside where she's greeted by Nick, who has flowers, they embrace, and then it does the freeze frame fade to black, which I love! And yeah, so the film ends with her being accepted. And being accepted!
Yeah, and I agree with you, there doesn't seem to be much logic to the idea of him, you know, deliberately sabotaging his movie. I almost imagine if he indeed was doing this on purpose, it's just such a passive-aggressive approach to, oh my god, I've created a disaster of a film. Because, I mean, it's the thing, this was not a guaranteed hit by any stretch of the imagination. Like, I can't imagine anybody involved in this film could have foreseen the amount of success it was going to have afterwards.
And I mean, when you look up, like, we listed the actresses that auditioned for the role of Alex and were turned down. There were many others that were offered the role and turned it down. And for the role of Nick, I think I read that Al Pacino, Kevin Costner, I think Warren Beatty at one point. Like, these were all people that, like, it seems like Simpson and Bruckheimer were like, come on, please, take this role. And they're like, I don't know, maybe it's not for me. It's stunning the amount of people that were offered parts in this film and then declined it.
Yeah, that's just the thing. I mean, even Paramount supposedly, even though they funded the whole film, they sold, I guess, a 25% stake in it to PolyGram, I guess, as a preventative to try and, you know, recoup something. Because they weren't even sure if this thing was going to hit at all. And so it's one of those things where I have to imagine that it could have very well been a case where everybody was looking at the dailies and just shaking their head and realizing, oh, God, this isn't going to work, is it? Like, nothing about this is going to, you know, succeed. And, I mean, again, they all lucked out, certainly. But, I mean, I don't understand what Adrian Lyne was thinking when he shoots that final scene and decides, I'm abandoning everything we've done up to this point. You know, to hide the fact that Jennifer Beals is not dancing at all.
Yeah, because for the other scenes, they edit very well around that. And unless you're looking for, you know, those the reverse shots or the way that the cuts are matched up, you know, if you're looking for it, you can see where there's probably a body swap, not like as we saw last week. But, you know, you can see where the stunt dancers, when all of a sudden it's them in the frame. Like, the film is actually pretty good about cutting around it in every scene except for this one.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what blows my mind about this, unless it was a case where they shot the climax first and then realized afterwards, oh God, we can't do this for the entire movie, and change style at that point. But then you would assume that at least somebody would have sat there and said, well, let's then spend the money and reshoot the scene at the end of production because we cannot let this thing sit.
Yeah, and then they pulled out the ledger and said, well, we'd love to, but we just used up the last of our budget. We can't afford any more film. We have to use it.
Well, exactly. And it's like, I mean, I don't get it. Like, it really, nothing about the, I mean, but I guess what then throws me is, it's not just the fact that the film is this fundamentally broken at the end of the day. It's the fact that then people went to see it again and again and again throughout 1983.
But I can understand that, actually. I can understand that the way this film is put together, again, I think it's a testament to Simpson and Bruckheimer, like, just having an understanding of popular tastes. Like, this film is slick where it counts. Its dance scenes are highly stylized and very memorable. The soundtrack is incredible. Even aside from the Oscar-nominated songs, like, Manhunt, that is a great song! You know, it's, there are so many elements of this film that work really well, and they're all at the level of style. And the thing is, I think most people, they are more than content with a simple story if it looks cool, because if a film looks cool enough, it's very easy to overlook some of the more maddening details. And I think that's something that you and I take for granted as people with a background in film analysis and film criticism. Because when we pull a film apart and we look at it through different critical lenses, theoretical lenses, ideological lenses, political lenses, stylistic, art movement lenses, you know, we throw all of that on and every single time, that abstracts us further and further from the fact that most people are totally okay throwing on a movie to entertain themselves. And I'm not saying that derisively, and I'm not saying that because I think it's wrong or the way that we approach film is any better. I think, though, that a film like Flashdance, if you're purely looking at it through an analytical lens like we do, it is very difficult to reconcile. Because it's like, how on earth would anybody like it? So you have to pay attention to the shiny objects, and they happen to be very shiny due to the sheer amount of polish, and that is probably why this film is fondly remembered and avidly consumed by 1983 audiences.
I guess it really is one of these things where I can understand if it was an ironic enjoyment of some of these things. And I say this, and the thing is, Andrew, I completely agree with you, because, yeah, the surface of this movie is gorgeous. I mean, it is, you know, again, one of these things that's tailor-made for someone like me who eats this stuff up. It's just one of those things where I'm just trying to think about this. I mean, if a feminist audience was coming to see this movie...
Don't.
That's just it. And again, ostensibly, this film was marketed in a way that was predominantly towards women. The actual film clearly isn't. I mean, I'm sure the close-ups on not Jennifer Beals' pelvic thrusts would prove that.
Kind of undercut by the mustache.
Oh, boy. But, I mean, the point is, I mean, it's just like, it feels like such a real bait and switch in terms of, this is the movie we sold, this is the film we delivered, but you were all okay with that. And, I mean, you're not wrong. I can completely see where you're coming from and why, yeah, audiences would probably react to it like that. To me, this feels like this was, you know, tailor-made for appearing on Mystery Science Theater 3000 at some point, because I can't take this film with a straight face at all.
But let me put it to you this way. How many other Mystery Science Theater films grossed $150 million and then won an Oscar in the process?
Good point. Irene Cara's love or Flashdance, What a Feeling, did win the best original song that year, and was nominated alongside Maniac from the film as well. And again, I'm not sure what the competition aside from it was in 19 at the 84 Oscars.
Theme from Das Boot
could be, but it's one of those things where, yeah, I mean, Flashdance, What a Feeling is a great flippin' song.
Yeah, whenever I hear it on the radio, I forget that it's the song from Flashdance, because it's got that synth sweep, it's got that towering pre-chorus of a land made of steel, made of stone, and I'm like, I just feel something swell, and I basically want to go on, like, a prog rock pioneer journey, and then all of a sudden the chorus comes in, and I'm like, oh yeah, bucket of water.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and you're right, the rest of the soundtrack is flipping amazing. I mean, even putting aside Laura Branigan's contributions of Gloria and Imagination, both killer tracks in this movie, you also get things such as, yeah, the previously mentioned I Love Rock and Roll by Joan Jett. You get, what else is on this thing? Manhunt, performed by Karen Ichui Mermone. I know I just botched that.
But I love hearing it anyway.
Yeah, Lady, Lady, Lady by Joe Esposito. The performer of You're the Best, the song from the Karate Kid soundtrack. Seduce Me Tonight by Cycle V, or 5, I'm not sure which way it's supposed to be properly
Cycles. Yeah, yeah, like, I mean, well, honestly, David, I think now that we're getting to that point and we finally pulled a positive out of the movie Flashdance, maybe we should steer it towards our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits, where we look at the little things that made us grin and groan in, well, probably not equal measure. But so I think, David, it's safe to assume that you and I are going to list the same hit. And yep. I think it's going to be the soundtrack of this film, which, oddly enough, the soundtrack was compiled by Giorgio Moroder.
Yeah, well, who, honestly, I know he's a figure that some people like to mock these days. I friggin' love his work. Not just here, I love it on Midnight Express. His version of Metropolis, that the restoration he oversaw and produced an entirely new soundtrack for, which needs to be seen to believe. I love that music. And honestly, as much as I'm happy that we have the complete Metropolis in its original form now, I kind of prefer the 80 version, the 80s version of it.
Well, yeah. And I mean, he also did the score for Paul Schrader's remake of Cat People, which features theme from Cat People, which is the greatest David Bowie song that he didn't write himself, I guess. That's less of a song and more like a Category 5 storm that lasts 5 minutes. It's, yeah. You know, he's widely considered as like the godfather of disco, and, you know, just very, very pioneering in his orchestrations, in his use of synthesizers. His influence goes from, like, you know, Ennio Morricone to Daft Punk. So he can do a lot, and it, putting him in charge of the soundtrack for the film was the absolute right decision.
No, unmistakably. I mean, this film, if it did not have the soundtrack, would not work a fraction as good as it does. So,
yeah.
Kudos to you, Marauder.
Like, the success of the soundtrack as an independent record, it's, you know, it's like a more magnified version of Tim Burton's Batman, where, you know, it's like the success of the soundtrack directly informs the success of the movie, only here just more so.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, yeah, kudos there. What about you, Andrew? Is there another hit that you have that we haven't previously mentioned or really needs to be reinforced here?
You know, even trying to be generous. I think Michael Nouri, even though his character is deeply flawed, I think he actually has a certain amount of 80s leading man charm that I can see why they cast him in this role, and I can see why, on the basis of this, like, other bigger projects probably should have come his way. He has a very, like, aw shucks naturalism that doesn't feel forced, and yeah. Considering that a lot of the other performances in this film are very stock and wooden or histrionic, he's probably the only person that plays his role like a human being. And yeah, he's on the arts council and runs a construction company and is in love with his employee half his age, but he actually, in his scene-by-scene interactions with everybody, he comes off as likable. He comes off as human, and as far as the performances go, probably the best one in the film.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, it's one of those things where I'm almost curious as to why he didn't have a somewhat of a bigger career than he has had. Because you're right. I mean, he has all of what we would consider the traditional qualities of a leading man are. And certainly having this film on your resume is not a bad thing to have by any stretch. And yet, I'm trying to think if there's honestly another film that Michael Nouri starred in aside from The Hidden that really has the same level of clout or at least some cachet amongst people, and it doesn't really exist. I mean, certainly it isn't Captain America 1990.
I was very tempted to actually link up to that one, but I realized, well, your old show. It said everything that needs to be said about that Captain America. Like, it seems like he's worked consistently, just nothing that was ever as high profile or probably as commercially successful as a project like Flashdance ever again. I think that's kind of a shame, but, you know, in terms of the cast, he's probably the bright spot.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would certainly agree. And actually, you know what? Why we're on this note, I will give props to one other actor in this film, even though, again, Sonny Johnson as Jeannie is actually, she is more likable than I think anybody in the film making the film realized. Like, she's not a movie star, as it were, but she is charming. She is likable. You know, there is, you know, you feel sympathy for her, certainly over the course of this movie, which, again, not to knock Jennifer Beals, but she accomplishes that to a far greater extent than Beals ever does in this movie. And again, when you're given a character this miserably treated by the film itself, by its end, you know, I feel a certain degree of sympathy for the actor for having to put up with the clearly ridiculous material they give her in the final third of this film. So, kudos to Sonny Johnson on that one.
And if I'm not mistaken, didn't she pass away very suddenly, like less than a year after this film came out?
She did die in 1984. Funny enough, I didn't look up the cause, but
let's, I think it was a cerebral hemorrhage.
Ruptured aneurysm. Yeah.
It's, and I mean, that's a shame because I can, I don't know if she would have ever like emerged as a leading actress, but I mean, definitely through like the 1980s, I could see her slotting very easily into a supporting role in other projects. And it is kind of sad that we never got to see her get that chance.
No, absolutely. So, yeah, kudos to the late Sonny Johnson in this instance. But I guess with, having said, I think probably all the hits we're probably going to give it. Andrew, what are some pits we really want to either double down on or mention that we haven't done so thus far?
Well, the hardest part is, well, A, remembering all the things that infuriated us about this movie, and B, finding things that we haven't talked about in the discussion proper. This one I was saving because it's actually the worst thing I've seen in this movie, and probably the worst thing I've seen in any movie, and that is the crossing guard sequence.
Oh, God.
Because
Please.
there's one part which is fairly charming, where Jeannie and Alex are walking down the street and they come across a bunch of neighborhood kids that are breakdancing. Then all of a sudden we get like some cuts to like the crowd getting bigger and all sorts of diverse people just enjoying the act of dancing on the street. Though I like to imagine that like in real time, like 7 hours pass by and then like the next shot all of a sudden it's pitch dark outside and all these raccoons chase after them. But like apropos of nothing though, we then cut to Alex and Jeannie walking down the street in a totally different location, and there's a policeman who's dancing while he's conducting traffic, and what follows is like a pure panto sequence of him and Alex just like coordinating around each other, and it ends with him pantomiming, drawing his gun from his holster and shooting her. I mean, that's weird. I mean, the fact that it's completely acontextual is weird. But I think the biggest problem is that for all the slick polish of this film, this like 2 minutes of the film made me think I was watching an episode of Just for Laughs Gags, and I never ever want to feel that ever again. So, yeah, that's probably my big pit so far. What about you, David?
The first one I have here is Kyle T. Hefner, the dude playing Richie. And it's not entirely Hefner's fault because, yeah, Richie is a terrible character on the page. But as played by Hefner, he's just pathetic throughout the scene. I don't understand why anybody wants to be around this guy in this film. Like, legitimately, there's nothing to him. Like, he's annoying, he is obnoxious, he is offensive.
Yeah, he only
He
gets a laugh when he's self-deprecating, and even then, like, the crowd's laugh response, when you actually consider, like, the inherent humor in the things he's saying, it's, like, so dramatically disproportionate.
Well, precisely, like, this guy is just like, I am, on one hand, as much as I would rather the scene, at least what happens to Jeannie before this film closes out and seeing whether, things improve for her, I am personally happy that there is no reconciliation scene between her and the Richie character, because I don't want to see them back together. I want to see him just disappear and not exist in this movie going forward, because there's nothing to him. He's just obnoxious and terrible and annoying, and I don't know why anybody would put up with, either put up with him as an employee, or as a romantic partner, or as a friend.
What
So
about an alternate ending where Alex returns, goes to Zanzibar, and discovers that Richie sold out his dreams and now he's dancing there?
everybody, if it ended with them just saying, "Are we going to do anything about this?" No, and then they just walk out, I'd be fine with that.
Oh, and the sign now says Manzibar.
And on that note, Andrew, what is your another pitch from you?
I don't know really. It's like it's trying to pull one thread out of an entire knot, you know? I think I've outlined all my biggest gripes, so I will concede the rest of my time to the gentleman from the other side of the Skype call.
Okay, well, putting aside, although I was tempted to list the construction worker, construction fight slash makeup scene with the construction workers all looking on as Alex and Nick walk off into the distance and cheering it, which is a moment I truly hate in this movie. No, I'm really going to lambast this movie for one reason and one reason alone, and that is for a single mistake on the soundtrack to this film.
Okay.
You have a bar in this movie named Zanzibar, and not once did you consider putting the Billy Joel song Zanzibar on the soundtrack.
They had to pay extra for it.
I'm just saying here, you had your opportunity here, folks, and you blew it. Okay? And not to mention, Zanzibar, it's a good song. So, my recommendation, skip renting Flashdance, buy that song off of iTunes, or better yet, if you can get your hands on the album, listen to it as well. It's worth it, folks.
So, to recap, Flashdance, problematic, and Billy Joel, pretty good.
Except for the drinking and driving side of things, but we'll put that aside for now.
See, I actually thought about going there, and I said, no, Andrew, let's just end on a positive note. Thank you,
Yep.
David. Thank you
You're
so
welcome.
much. And thank you above all for choosing this film. Like it or not, though, it's undeniable that Flashdance had an impact on audiences of its time, on music video aesthetics, and how those aesthetics got incorporated into cinema. I mean, rapid editing and that, it's not to say that it all started here, but I mean, like, this is part of that journey. And I mean, for good or for ill, well, it's a feeling and it's a film.
That, yes, it is. So, with that, folks, I guess I'm turning the wheel over to you, Andrew, to select where we're going next. Please don't seek revenge. Where are we heading
Well,
next?
actually, I think we're going to forego the vehicle for an airplane simply because then I can finally drop my classic leaving on a jet plane joke that I've been working on. We are going to follow Li Ving, who gave a vocal performance in Ralph Bakshi's 1981 American Pop, an animated film telling a story of four generations of Jewish immigrants trying to make it in the world of American music. I haven't seen it for a number of years. I remember watching it as a kid and having the doors of perception kicked open. And I'm looking very, very forward to discussing it with you, Dave.
Excellent. This will be a first watch for me, so I am dying to see where this takes us.
All right. Well, you're never going to listen to Night Moves the same way ever again. But before we go working on our night moves, Dave, where can people get in touch with us?
Well, if they want to yell at me on Twitter about how much they love Flashdance and how I missed all the nuance and subtleties and romance of the film, I'm at 24 panels. What about you, Andrew? Where can they find you on Twitter?
They can find me at FilmsTripper. And if you want to help us grow our audience and leave some other critical feedback, the best way to do that is by leaving a 5-star review on iTunes or whatever podcasting service you use. 5-star reviews help bring more attention to our humble little show, but more importantly, by rating and reviewing, you help us know what we need to do differently, what we need to keep doing, and what we should never, ever even allow ourselves to pretend thinking about. At the end of the day, we want to make the kind of show that people like you at home want to listen to. And, well, if you don't tell us what you want it to be, we can never make it into what that is.
Yeah. So, with that, Andrew, are there any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Why, yes, David, there are. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Hopefully, Richie. Bye.
Here, I thought there was going to be like a Hannah's Death over the phone gag.